Hello and welcome to episode 217 of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong here in Istanbul. In this episode, we speak to Christopher Phillips. He is Professor of International Relations at Queen Mary, University of London, and the author of the new book, Battleground, 10 Conflicts That Explain the New Middle East, published by Yale University Press. As suggested by the title, the book is divided into 10 chapters, each exploring a different regional conflict where rival powers have been jostling for influence. It paints a fiendishly complicated picture of a region in flux, where there's no longer any one power that can impose order, but where numerous ambitious middle powers, including Turkey, are rubbing up against each other, sometimes openly, sometimes not so openly, and often resulting in violence and instability. Of course, Israel-Palestine and various regional players' views of that conflict is one of the key theatres explored in the book, but our conversation ranges more broadly, trying to dig into the underlying causes of why instability seems to be proliferating across the region. Specifically in relation to Turkey, we address how Ankara's push for greater influence in Syria, Iraq, and Libya has reverberated on its ties with other regional and global players and what that means going forward. But before we get started, I'm going to appeal once again for your support. It takes a lot of time and effort to read all these books, prepare the podcast, edit it, and put it out there into the world. And I do need listeners' support, your support, to be able to keep going. Since 2015, we've given a platform to researchers and authors working on Turkish history, politics, society, literature, and the arts. Turkey Book Talk is completely independent with no sponsorships. It depends 100% on the goodwill of listeners like you. So if you are able to support, please consider becoming a Turkey Book Talk member on Patreon. Supporting on Patreon is a nice thing to do, and it also gets you some pretty good extras. Those extras include a 35% discount on all books published in IB Taurus and Bloomsbury's Great Turkey and Ottoman History series. As a member, you get a special code to use at the online checkout, which you can use to purchase hundreds of titles in that IB Taurus Bloomsbury Turkey and Ottoman History series. Members also receive a PDF transcript of every interview when the episode is published, and you get transcripts of the whole archive of our interviews, including some previously unpublished extras. And finally, to members, I also send links to a couple of articles related to the subject of the episode upon publication, which is ideal if you want to delve that bit deeper. To become a member, just go to Turkey Book Talk's Patreon page and pledge $3, €3, or £2.50 per episode. You can pledge more if you want, but whatever you pledge, membership is entirely at your own discretion. There are no strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. But now on to our conversation with Christopher Phillips. The book ranges across the region and compresses a huge amount of detail into a single volume very impressively. So I started by asking him what he wanted to achieve with the book.
Well, I suppose the central aim was to offer an accessible study or an accessible guide for people that aren't that familiar with the international relations of the Middle East. I was really conscious that a lot of journalism, a lot of commentators, a lot of politicians, and even, you know, my own students, when they first come to this broad question of the international relations of the Middle East, are often overawed by what looks like a really complicated part of the world. And especially when they look at wars and conflicts within it. And as a consequence, people tend to drift towards the simpler or simplified explanations. You see a lot of stuff in the press about blaming everything on religion or the legacies of colonialism or contemporary American policy or the presence of oil in the region and things like this. And what I wanted to do was sort of do two things, which is, on the one hand, create a guide that allowed people a relatively easy way into the region. But at the same time, I didn't want them to be afraid of complexity. And I wanted them to be aware that these conflicts were complex and complicated. And actually, the reason behind them was multifaceted. And whilst all of those factors that I mentioned did play a role, they were very rarely the sole reason for conflict in the region. And so what I tried to do was create this guide to break the region down into 10 zones of conflict and to use those as a way to enter the region relatively easily. So if you just want to know what's going on in Syria, you can just read that chapter, about 8,000 words, and you'll get a good overview of that conflict. You'll be able to understand the complexities of the conflict without being overawed by everything else that's going on in the region. But if you then want to go to the next step and look at another conflict zone, whether it be Egypt or the Gulf or Iraq or Lebanon, then you've got the opportunity to do that. And the idea was that if people want to read the whole of the book, at the end of reading it, they'll get a good overview of the international relations of the region. They'll understand those complexities and see how these arenas all interact and interlink with one another. But at the same time, they'll hopefully have read it in a sort of almost step-by-step way so that they don't feel overawed by it. So that was kind of the overarching logic behind the book.
You write at one point that your aim is to, quote, underline the complexity of international relations in the region known as the Middle East. Simplified explanations for conflict and instability, such as religion, oil, or imperialism, are inadequate and unhelpful. Rather, these factors feed into a wider, more nuanced, multifaceted set of causes and explanations. There's no one easy to understand explanation. So that's really getting to that point that you were just outlining there. It's very hard to find particular bête noires or particular responsible parties as being the sole reason for any one conflict erupting. There's many moving parts all interacting in very complicated ways. And it seems like that's what the book succeeds in demonstrating, really.
I'm glad you saw that that was absolutely my intention when I wrote the book. In many ways, and you're familiar with the Syria conflict, the whole idea of the book came out of observing exactly the same patterns in one particular conflict. So I'm originally a specialist in Syria. I lived there for several years before the war, and the last book that I wrote, called The Battle for Syria, looked at one conflict but described the same pattern. You know, it was a conflict that was characterized in the West in often quite a simplified way. You know, there was a tendency to emphasize internal divisions within Syria along ethnic and sectarian lines, whether it would be between Sunnis and Shias or between Arabs and Kurds. And that simplified narrative absolutely dominated, certainly in the early years of that conflict. But what I saw was a complicated domestic conflict that had been heavily influenced by external actors, all of whom had their own agendas and were pulling the dynamics of the Syria conflict in different ways, whether it was Turkey, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the US, or Russia. And when I sort of zoomed out across the region, as I came to the end of that project, I realized that actually this dynamic occurs across the region. And you could see that this played out rather like in Syria in other civil conflicts, so places like Yemen, places like Libya, but also in places that had contested politics where violence wasn't necessarily the way in which the politics was being contested. You'd have places like Egypt, you'd have places like Lebanon, places like Iraq, even the Gulf, and further afield, the Horn of Africa, where there were competing parties within a state or within a region. You, on the one hand, had to deal with the historical complexity in play, whether it be the legacy of colonialism or the socioeconomic structure of that particular state, but you'd also get these regional and international powers wading in, supporting one side or another, or multiple sides in some cases, like in Lebanon or the Horn of Africa, again, greatly impacting the dynamics of what was happening in that state. So you think of something like what happened in Egypt after their revolution of 2011. You saw complex internal dynamics playing out between, say, the military and the Muslim Brotherhood and democratic activists. But then you got the United States, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, wading in as well, wanting one faction to effectively win that struggle, ultimately concluding in the 2013 coup against the Muslim Brotherhood. So that was a pattern not just seen in Syria, not just seen in conflicts like Yemen and Libya, but also in politics, like in Egypt. And I hope that the book shows that it's a pattern that is repeated over and over again.
Yeah. Do you think that pattern is multiplying in any way? Because it seems like that is a theme that has become more and more clear over the last, even just a decade. It seems like these various areas of conflict, they're kind of metastizing in a way. Previously, they were obviously also extremely complicated. But you give the example of Syria, for example, that question has obviously become fiendishly complex because of the multiplicity of actors that got involved over the years. And, you know, that perhaps wasn't the case in Syria, obviously, before the war started. You talk about how, you know, large parts of the Middle East in the 21st century have become arenas for external competition, meaning that there are now more unstable states and regions, more non-state actors operating within them, and more regional and international powers willing to intervene in these areas, either through sponsoring domestic players or deploying their own militaries. So that all points to an even more complicated situation, perhaps even more complicated than just 10 years ago even. Do you see that as a trajectory where things are only getting more complex as more and more actors weigh into the ring, basically, and seek to leverage influence in whatever way they can against each other? Is that dynamic getting worse, or is there a lid on that kind of competition that we're seeing?
Yeah, you know, it's a really interesting question, and one that, looking to the future, I can't say for certain of what will happen. I think if you talk about the last 10 years, or at least the last 13 years, let's say, since the Arab uprisings of 2011, I think that absolutely has been the dynamic that has shifted in the region. And I talk about this in the book. You see an eruption of the number of states willing to intervene in their neighbors' affairs. And at the same time, you see an eruption of the number of unstable states in which intervention could happen. So prior to 2011, when you look at the Middle East as a whole, you might talk of one or two quote unquote weak states. You might talk about Lebanon. You might talk about perhaps Yemen. And after 2003, you might talk about Iraq. But then after 2011, those three states are still unstable. Yemen becomes even more unstable. But you add to that list Syria, you add to that list Libya, you add to that list Egypt. And even for a short time, you might talk about Bahrain, and later on what happens in Qatar with the Qatar blockade. So suddenly there's a lot of states that are unstable. And at the same time, you have an explosion of the number of states willing to intervene. So you have the states that historically did intervene in the region, like Egypt, Iraq, and Syria, have become quite weak. But you've got new states that historically didn't get that involved. So Turkey, for example, for decades was aloof and disinterested in the Middle East. But from 2002 onwards, it starts to get more involved and intervenes directly in multiple arenas. Iran, which was physically blocked from getting involved in much of the Middle East beyond Lebanon prior to the fall of Saddam Hussein in 2003, suddenly, with Saddam Hussein falling, has access to Iraq and the states beyond it. And then you have smaller states like the UAE and Qatar, which again, historically were too small and weak to get involved in regional affairs, at least to a large extent, suddenly becoming very activist. And also Saudi Arabia, which, though powerful, had historically preferred to allow other states, such as Iraq or the United States, to take the lead in foreign policy in the region, and it would sort of support it or sponsor it rather than directly getting involved itself. So suddenly you've got this vast explosion in the number of states willing to intervene, and a great increase in the number of places where they can intervene. On top of that, you look at the global dynamics, whereas previously it was really just the United States, at least since in the post-Cold War era, that were willing to intervene in the Middle East. After sort of the mid-2000s, and certainly after 2011, you'd add Russia to that in terms of military intervention, but you'd also add China in terms of economic intervention and economic involvement. And I actually did some data work on this as part of the book, and you see a really large increase in the number of states intervening in civil wars between 1945 and 2008 in all of the conflicts, the sort of the civil wars that take place in the Middle East in that time. The average number of foreign states getting involved in those civil wars is about two per conflict. Since 2008 to the present day, the number of states getting involved in civil wars on average is number six. So it's a really large increase in each one of those conflicts, you know, Syria, Yemen, Libya, you're not just seeing one or two leading actors getting involved, like, say, for example, in the 1960s in the North Yemeni civil war. It was basically Saudi backing one side and Egypt backing the other side. In the conflict of today, you've got multiple actors backing multiple internal players. And that is certainly a recipe for instability, which I try to outline in the book.
You also talk about how one way of looking at how this regional jigsaw has been shaken up is this idea of the post-American Middle East. Obviously, that's coming a bit more into view with the prospect of Donald Trump being re-elected and US isolationism that people say that would herald. But this is also a wider trend as well, because, you know, a series of US presidents have sought to withdraw somewhat from the Middle East to reduce the US footprint, you know, really going back to Obama, obviously the first Trump presidency. Biden has also sought to refocus elsewhere. And you make the point in the book that this is an important framework potentially for looking at what's happening. We're talking about these multiplicity of new actors with new appetites, new ambitions in the region rubbing up against each other. The opportunity to do that may be a result of the US retreating from the region and these various other actors scrambling to fill the vacuum. You say in the book that, quote, there's no obvious regional hegemon in the Middle East, but rather a series of middle-sized powers. So is that a useful framework for looking at the spread of chaos, essentially, in the region where, you know, you've got no one dominant power, but you've got many, many ambitious powers clashing with each other? You know, unlike in previous years, for better or for worse, there's no US that's basically the hegemon in the region anymore, essentially keeping a lid on things. Now it's almost every actor for themselves. And in that scenario, we're seeing a lot of turbulence.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's one of the book's core arguments, is that the shifts that I was describing just now, the explosion of the number of actors getting involved in these conflicts, is triggered by a perceived retreat of the United States. And I say perceived, and that's an important word, because actually the United States isn't any less militarily involved in the region, rather, than it was, say, in the 1990s, which was an era of US dominance. It still has all its bases in the Gulf. It has a thin presence in Iraq and Syria that didn't have in the 1990s. But in the 1990s and 2000s, there was a perception in the region after the end of the Cold War and after the US ejected Saddam Hussein from Kuwait and George H.W. Bush talked about his New World Order. There was this sense that the US was the dominant power, and the way it behaved was as a hegemon. And most regional states cut their cloth accordingly. So you had states like Iran, Iraq, and at times Syria and Libya positioning themselves as, you know, the resistance axis, rejecting US dominance, and most other states embracing US dominance and leaning into the US and effectively allowing it to be this sort of hegemon and looking to it for leadership. Didn't mean they did everything the US wanted, but it was very much how they framed their security and their diplomatic alignment. Since, and you're quite right, you know, the shift came under Barack Obama, not under Donald Trump. And in many ways, despite them having different styles, Trump, Obama and Biden have all sought the same thing, which is less involvement structurally in the Middle East and a shift to priorities elsewhere in the world, most notably China, but obviously also in the case of Biden, the Ukraine war and facing down Russia. But when that occurred in the time period that I really focus on heavily, around the time of the Arab uprising of 2011, that prompted the regional actors, many of whom had come to expect the US to intervene and to get involved in regional politics, to take on the burden themselves and to begin to think, okay, well, the US isn't going to intervene in conflicts that we wanted it to intervene in, like in Syria or Yemen. So we're going to have to do it ourselves. And that prompts this real shift from former allies, well, still existing allies, but states that used to rely heavily on the United States, like Saudi Arabia, like the UAE, like Qatar, like Turkey, to effectively pursue their own agendas. That doesn't mean they've separated completely from the United States, but it means they're no longer looking for permission, let's say, from the US to pursue a lot of their regional politics. And then you throw into the mix a more assertive Iran, which has obviously never sought the US's permission for anything, but because of US policy has been given the opportunity to intervene more heavily because, again, as I mentioned, the removal of Saddam Hussein and what's seen as a free hand in Syria, this allows Iran to be a far more active player than it was in those eras of US dominance. So, yes, I think that the role that the US plays is absolutely key in explaining this shift. Now, whether or not that's a good or a bad thing is a big question. I do address it in the conclusion. I think that one of the problems is that some might conclude from that that the problem has been the US stepping back, that actually in the 1990s and 2000s, there was perhaps a degree of stability when everyone recognized that the US was the hegemon, and now it stepped back, there's more chaos. The problem is twofold. Firstly, the US's position wasn't sustainable. You saw with the war on terror, the problem of kind of imperial overreach, you might call it, and actually the fact that the US just doesn't have the capacity to play that policeman of this region or any other region. And eventually you get domestic backlash where there's been a big reaction against the idea of boots on the ground and actually the American public not being willing to play that role, which is, I think, greatly informed a series of presidents, Obama, Trump, and now Biden. And then on the other hand, the other major shift that makes this it impossible to go back to that era of US hegemony is the global shift. Whereas the 1990s and 2000s, the US was clearly the only superpower in what we describe as a unipolar world or a unipolar moment. We're no longer living in that world. Depending on your metrics, China already has a larger economy than the United States. It's beginning to challenge it from the security position, although it's still quite a long way away. But as we've seen with things like the expansion of the BRICS, we now live in a multipolar world, and the US can't dominate global politics or indeed Middle Eastern politics in the way it once did. So even if the solution, quote unquote, was to return to US hegemony, and I don't think it would be, we're not in a position to return to that. So in many ways, we're back to where the Middle East was before that era of US dominance, back to sort of the 50s, 60s and 70s, where actually you've got quite powerful regional players, activists intervening in one another's affairs, but keeping the superpowers at a greater distance and trying to play superpower rivalry off one another to maximize their own interests. That happened in the early part of the Cold War, where states like Egypt used the superpower rivalry to try to maximize their own interests. And now we're seeing it in a different way with, for example, the Gulf states trying to utilize the rivalry between China and the US to maximize their own interests and flexibility. So it's not something we haven't seen before, but it is something that is really quite new from what we've seen in the last 30 or 40 years.
And Turkey is another one of those powers with increased appetites, looking to intervene in various different arenas to maximize its own interests, maybe exploiting this vacuum in a way, or at least reading the room and seeing this opportunity to be a more activist player. And, you know, most obviously is the case of Syria that we've seen over the last decade or so. Turkey's intervention in Syria has obviously had different phases. Initially, of course, backing rebels seeking the overthrow of Assad, and in more recent years, focusing more directly on this sort of national security question of combating Kurdish-led groups in northern Syria, preventing the emergence of autonomous spaces that could, in that perspective, threaten Turkey. And more recently, we've seen reports of rapprochement between Turkey and Assad. That seems to more recently have gone into the background, and the ambitions have been scaled back on that front. So it seems very vague, and there are multiple potential paths ahead. But how might that evolve in the years ahead, bearing in mind these different phases?
Sure. Well, I mean, if you think about Turkey more broadly, just taking a step back from Syria, its decision to get involved with Middle Eastern politics in a way that it hadn't until really 2002. Some say it might be cultural, it's down to sort of the AKP's more political Islamic focus than previous Kemalist governments. But there's also that, as you suggested, sort of that reading the room or taking advantage of the situation, which is that Turkey for a long time aspired to be Western facing, to become a European power, constantly rebuffed by the EU. In many ways, strategically, it made sense to look southwards, because whereas Turkey is, you know, a peripheral, let's say, European actor, it actually had the capacity to be a quite major Middle Eastern player. It had the most sophisticated and developed economy. It had not quite the largest military, but certainly the most technically developed military. And so actually had the sort of, you know, capacity to dominate its immediate neighbors, which were descending into chaos in the cases of both Iraq and Syria, and also to make a good fist of playing a sizable regional role. So, you know, entering into the arena for some ways made sense for Turkey, especially led by a government that had ambitions to be a leader of the immediate environment, the post-Ottoman world, and perhaps more broadly the Islamic world. So it did make sense to get more involved. On the specific point of Syria, it's an interesting evolution, as you talked about, that Turkey has gone through. I think broadly speaking, my assessment would be Turkey's Syria policy has largely failed. It made a very conscious decision in 2011, perhaps an understandable one, but a very conscious decision to cut ties with the regime of Bashar al-Assad and to actively support the rebel movement against him. That rebel movement has not succeeded in overthrowing Assad as Turkey had hoped. Syria, previously having been a very stable southern neighbor, is now a very unstable neighbor. And as a consequence, Turkey has been flooded with up to 4 million refugees, which are now causing a degree of instability within the Turkish political and economic structure at home. It has been targeted by ISIS terrorist attacks, and it's been targeted by groups linked to the PYD and PKK. As a consequence, Turkey has completely altered its Syria policy and has shifted to a more defensive position, trying to firstly create and defend buffer zones that would keep PYD militants away from its border. Now, in this regard, it's somewhat more successful in that it has managed to both stabilize the southern front as such and keep many PYD operatives off the border. But it goes back to this question of sustainability. Is this a sustainable position in the long run? How much is it a personal project for Recep Tayyip Erdogan? If he were to lose power at some point, would future governments, whether led by the AKP or another party, want to maintain these buffer zones? How long can Turkey hold out in this position? Is it desirable to? I think most people would conclude that in most examples in history, such zones don't last for a long time. And eventually the home country, in this case, Turkey, will recognize that this isn't in their interest. They don't want to maintain these territories and they step back. So really the question is when, not if. At some point, it must be presumed, unless something really dramatically changes, that a Turkish government is going to recognize that Assad is not going anywhere in Damascus and these buffer zones and this position that they're holding isn't sustainable. But the question is, how long will that take? I'm unsure. I look again at Turkish foreign policy in the last 20 years, but certainly in the last 10 years, it's been very personalized around Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He's personally invested a lot in these buffer zones. He's invested a lot in keeping his support for the remnants, the rebels, and not recognizing Assad. Whether or not he's able to somehow shift on that position without losing face is questionable. Again, there are questions about the Syrian refugees in Turkey. It's a very popular move would be to try to move those refugees back into Syria, but they don't want to go back to Syria where Assad is. And so it's really hard to find a situation in which with Erdogan as leader, he could both swallow the humiliation of compromising on Assad and survive any backlash against either, on the one hand, pushing the refugees back into Syria, or on the other hand, not pushing them back into Syria. So it's a very difficult position. At the moment, he seems to be treading water. It will require a lot of political skill to move forward on it, which is why I wonder if we might just see a lot of maintaining the status quo for quite a few years yet.
You make the point in the book about the PYD's long-running links going back years to Assad's and the central authorities in Damascus, and basically their coordination with it. And part of that coordination, of course, in previous decades was the long-running backing of Bashar al-Assad and his father before him for the PKK. And that's not really talked about too often in Turkey these days, but it seems like a crucial thing that people should keep in mind amid this deck being reshuffled in Syria potentially. How do you see those ties these days? You know, have they transformed over the years with the civil war? Could they take a new form? How will that influence the process going forward?
Yeah, it's a really fascinating point that you raise, actually. I mention it in the chapter that I focus on Kurdistan. I actually mentioned that this isn't strange behavior. Actually, almost all of the states that have Kurdish populations, so Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran, at different times have sponsored Kurdish groups in foreign states as ways of pressuring their neighbors, whilst at the same time repressing Kurdish groups in their own states. So in Syria's case, Hafez al-Assad, Bashar's father, sponsored the PKK and allowed them to set up training camps in both Lebanon and Syria, whilst at the same time repressing Kurds in Syria itself. And it was a way of pressuring Turkey, which at the time was on the opposite side of the Cold War, and Syria has had long territorial claims to the Hatay region of Turkey. So it was a way of influencing Turkish politics. That relationship largely ended in the late 1990s. So in 1998, Turkey famously threatened to go to war if Syria didn't expel Abdullah Öcalan, the leader of the PKK, who was resident in Syria at the time. And Syria backed down and did eject him, and he was eventually arrested by Turkish authorities. From that point onwards, Syria didn't really have a sort of official relationship anymore with the PKK. But because of those decades of sponsorship, there was a degree of friendliness towards their Syrian arm, which became the PYD. And the PYD was allowed to operate within Bashar al-Assad's Syria. They formed in 2004-2005. Again, they were ideological followers of Abdullah Öcalan and very closely aligned with the PKK, although they did insist they were a different group. They were very much a Syrian Kurdish group, but very closely linked. And because of that, you did have this sort of historical closeness between Assad and the PYD. And it also meant that when the Syrian civil war blew up and Assad took the tactical decision on the advice of his ally Iran to step away from eastern Syria, there was a tacit agreement with the PYD that they would take over the territory that Assad was vacating. There were other Kurdish groups there, sponsored by, in particular, the Iraqi Kurdish government, but it was the PYD that ended up dominating. And that was partly because they'd effectively got a green light from Assad to do that. However, things have changed as a consequence of the war with ISIS. So as a consequence of the war with ISIS, as we know, the United States moved in. They helped the PYD form this new group, the Syrian Democratic Forces, or the SDF. And since, 2015 or so, the US have had a military presence on the ground in eastern Syria. They've been training PYD or SDF fighters. They've been helping them sort of develop governance structure and so on. And as a consequence, you now have a bit of a generational split within the PYD. The older generation remember those older ties with Assad. They have close ties with Russia because many of them during the 1980s and 90s would have gone off and trained in Russia. So that old guard are more instinctively in favor of reconciling with Assad moving forward and turning eastern Syria into a sort of quasi-autonomous part of Assad Syria. But the younger generation of the PYD, who have come of age in this conflict, are far less sympathetic to Assad because they don't have that historical memory, and far more sympathetic to the United States. They want the US to stay there for longer. They would ideally like a situation a bit like occurred in northern Iraq from 1991 to 2003, where you have this sort of American defended autonomous zone of Syria, a bit like we have now. So in many ways, it's a question of time. I think the longer the US remains in eastern Syria, the harder it's going to be for the PYD and SDF to reintegrate back into Assad Syria. But if they were to leave in the next couple of years, that older guard, that older generation still just about dominate PYD politics and could probably persuade the younger generation to accept an Assad-Russia reconciliation, in particular as a way of defending them from Turkey, which they would be very worried would attack them if the US was to leave.
Another piece of the puzzle is obviously Iraq, neighbouring Turkey, neighbouring Syria. And again, from Turkey's perspective, Iraq is really coming into focus a little bit more diplomatically in recent months, there's been a number of visits from Turkish officials to Iraqi Kurdistan and to Baghdad. And there's a lot of speculation about what this means. You know, Erdogan has come out repeatedly and said, you know, Turkey could stage more ambitious military campaigns into Iraq by the summer, basically against the PKK. Obviously, Turkey already stages airstrikes and, you know, has a pretty much semi-permanent military presence across northern Iraq. And its ambitions are growing there, essentially. And it seems like Turkey is trying to boost its influence there. And potentially that, of course, will put it at odds with Iran, which, of course, is the major external player in Iraq, the most dominant outside force by far. So, you know, if Turkey does continue this attempt to increase its footprint in Iraq, increase its military presence in northern Iraq against the PKK, how could that shift dynamics going forward? You know, potentially combustible situation with Iran there, or could that also potentially lead to a new dispensation where, you know, these outside players, Turkey, Iran, come to some kind of new balance in Iraq in a kind of more optimistic way? Or are they kind of on a collision course?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It's one that doesn't have a clear answer. I think I would say that in many ways, what you're describing is a repeat of the dynamics that have been at play in northern Iraq since 2003, at least, whereby in the Kurdish region, you have these two dominant parties, the KDP and the PUK. And they each, whilst aligning on many things, have also tended to be supported by different external patrons. So Turkey actually has been far closer to the KDP, which is more conservative, and Iran has been more supportive of the PUK. Because the PUK has historically been more sympathetic towards the PKK, again, so many acronyms when it comes to the Kurdish groups, but because the PUK has historically been more sympathetic to the PKK, that is one of the reasons why the KDP has allowed Turkey to launch these various military operations into Iraq against the PKK, because it's also a way of outflanking its main domestic rival. And this is a strategy that's been relatively successful. It's also one of the reasons why the PUK has been more sympathetic to Iran as a means to counter the support that Turkey has been offering to its main rival, the KDP. The third part of the jigsaw is the government in Baghdad. Historically, the government in Baghdad since 2003 has been incredibly weak. You know, it has been suffering from internal strife, from a civil war, and so hasn't really been able to influence Kurdish politics. But since the failed referendum attempt of 2017 in Erbil in Kurdish Iraq, and the parallel economic failures that the KRG went through, Baghdad has been able to be a little bit more influential. And I think that might be why, as you say, Turkey is launching diplomatic initiatives to get involved in Baghdad a little bit more, because it adds a further lever by which it can influence Kurdish politics, either pressuring the PKK, pressuring the PUK, or even its, you know, nominal ally, the KDP, to sort of square that circle there. However, because Baghdad is so closely aligned with Iran, I think that might suggest, or might be a way in which there will be a diffusing of tensions rather than a ratcheting up of tensions between Iran and Turkey in Kurdish Iraq, because I think that ultimately Turkey has the weaker hand because Iran and Baghdad, sort of like two sides of this triangle around the Kurdish region, are so close. They're sort of more the dominant force, and Turkey just has to sort of scrap for what it can as and when. Add to that that what we saw over Syria was, despite Turkey and Iran backing different sides and really disagreeing with one another's approaches, they have been able to maintain cordial ties themselves and compartmentalize their proxy conflicts elsewhere. So even if they reached a point, and I'm not sure this is going to happen, but if they reached a point where the Kurdish groups they're supporting in Iraq came to blows, I don't think that would lead to a rupture in Iranian-Turkish relations, because far worse happened in Syria, and they still managed to remain cordial, kept their borders open, kept trade going. They've been able to compartmentalize that quite well, and I don't see why that should be any different in Iraq.
Another arena that you focus on in the book, fiendishly complicated, is Libya. And we were talking about Syria earlier. And the way that you describe the external interventions in Libya, particularly Turkey's intervention in Libya, was actually deeply affected or impacted by the developments in Syria. So it just shows how, you know, the knock-on effect from one conflict to the next, the experiences of one power in one arena informing their moves elsewhere in the region. So you argue that Ankara's involvement in Libya is deeply connected to its experiences in Syria. Its stance in backing one side of the war in Libya is hard to understand without referring to its experiences in Syria. Could you elaborate on that point for us? How did, you know, Turkey's experiences in Syria, how did that change its behavior in a completely different arena?
Sure. I mean, and it's not just the experience in Syria. It's also their experience in Egypt as well. You know, in many ways, Libya becomes an outlet for Turkey to try to rebalance some of the perceived losses it's facing in the kind of regional chessboard, for want of a better word. You know, Egypt in 2013, the group that it supported, the Muslim Brotherhood, which was elected to power, is overthrown in a coup that's sponsored by Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the UAE. And especially, Turkey really resents the UAE's role in this and severs ties with the UAE. And it's only recently now, in the last year or so, rebuilt ties with the UAE. So for a whole decade, really, Ankara and Abu Dhabi are at odds. And of course, in Libya, when Haftar launches his rebellion as such against the elected parliament in Tripoli, the UAE is one of its main sponsors. His other main sponsor is Russia, whom, of course, as you mentioned, Turkey has at this point in 2017, 2018, Russia has just successfully pushed Turkey's allies in Syria out of most of its positions in central Syria. 2019, 2020, you get this, you know, showdown over Idlib, where effectively Turkey is forced to compromise. It has initially said it won't give up, you know, it doesn't think Assad should be granted any territory in Idlib. But when it reaches a point where actually it looks like Turkey and Russia might even end up fighting one another, Turkey has to take the step back, fly to Sochi and agree a compromise with Putin. It's at this point when Turkey sees, hang on a moment, we've got a position in Libya that we can use to pressure those rivals, Russia and the UAE, in a way that we seem to have been lost at. We've lost out in Egypt and Syria, which is when Turkey really steps up its presence in Libya, helping the elected government in Tripoli push back Haftar's forces relatively successfully. Though, of course, once again, as occurred in Syria, they very nearly come to blows. It's, you know, you reach a point around Sirte where there's a possibility that Turkish forces look like they're going to end up fighting Russian, UAE and Egyptian forces in Libya, and they manage to de-escalate and reach a ceasefire, which is largely held until now. So that's the way in which you can help understand Turkey's involvement in Libya, understanding the context of Egypt and Syria. Remember, Turkey was not one of the first states to get involved in Libya. Actually, it's a relative latecomer. You know, when Gaddafi fell, Turkey was relatively neutral. It actually kind of wanted Gaddafi to stay in power because Turkish companies had lots of contracts with Gaddafi. And then when Haftar first launched his rebellion, Turkey again wasn't really involved. It was heavily involved in Syria at the time and was still reeling from losing its position in Egypt. So it's really only when Turkey saw there was geopolitical advantage to be had that Turkey started getting involved in Libya. I would add, though, that there is another dimension to this, and I do mention it in the Libya chapter, that obviously there is also this gas exploration component for Turkey in Libya. Because Libya borders the disputed area in the eastern Mediterranean that Turkey has been disputing with Greece and Cyprus over its exploration, it and North Cyprus's exploration rights of gas fields there. One of the conditions of Turkey's intervention was for Tripoli to recognize Turkey's claims. But again, that still overplays those geopolitical rivalries, because one of the main sponsors of Greece's claims in the region was Egypt and the UAE again. So you see this interconnectedness of all the geopolitical rivalries playing out across these arenas.
And just to wrap things up, I was thinking as I was reading the book that the thesis that you put forward about, you know, these multiple interests having a determining impact on the way that various conflicts play out, it's proven by the experiences of Turkey over the past decade or so. So if we think about that immediate sort of post-Arab Spring era where Turkey had these grand ambitions of being the new hegemon, essentially, regionally, where it would support like-minded governments with far more popular legitimacy, democratically elected, Islamist leaning, and therefore, you know, usher in this new Turkey-led order across the region, a new golden age emerging in the region. There were these grand ambitions. And, you know, we've seen in recent years those ambitions kind of come crashing down to earth, essentially. And it really seems to be because there are these other interests that aren't just going to sit back and allow one player to just sweep the board. So Turkey is just one of many of these ambitious players that has a different vision for the region. And the idea that any one of them is just going to now impose their own ideal of what, you know, the regional order should be is really naive. It seems more and more as time passes, perhaps it was clear at the time people were saying it, but it seems even more obvious in retrospect that those ideas that a single power like Turkey could usher in a new status quo, essentially, based on what it wants, basically sidelining the interests of other players in the region, was never ever really realistic at all. There are always going to be multiple interests that are at play. And the question going forward is how those different interests interact. And it's not going to be 100% satisfying for anybody, any player at all, including Turkey, really. So I think your book kind of showed that reality of no one player is really going to be able to have it all their own way.
Yes, I think you're quite right. And I do mention it a little bit at the end of the book that the Middle East as a region, it's not unique, but in terms of the distribution of power between states, it's not like, as I say, China in Southeast Asia, where there's a single dominant power, or the US in North America, where there's a single dominant power, or Brazil and Argentina in Latin America, where there's two dominant powers, or even, you know, or the Indian subcontinent, where there's, you know, a single dominant power in the form of India. It's actually much more like Europe, where there are multiple potentially powerful states. And what we've seen in Europe up until the 20th, up to and including the 20th century, is attempts by single states to dominate, and that leading to failure and catastrophe. Now, thankfully, the Middle East has not experienced that, where one state has militarily sought to try to subjugate the others. But it has attracted the same mentality, let's say, as occurred in Europe, whereby states have had ambitions, as you say, to dominate, whether it's Turkey, whether it's Iran today, whether it's been, you know, Saddam Hussein's Iraq in the past, or Nasser's Egypt in the past, or even, you know, to a lesser extent, perhaps Saudi Arabia's ideas of being a dominant power as well. But because of the power imbalance in the region, because, as you say, there are too many rivals that would challenge any attempt at hegemony, all of those ambitions fail. Now, in the European case, and I'm not one to say, oh, you know, the Middle East is just like Europe, but 100 years behind, I think that's an incredibly orientalist viewpoint. It's not one that I share. But in terms of looking at sort of power dynamics, Europe went through several horrendous wars, after which its leaders recognized that they needed to reach some kind of status quo, some kind of accommodation with one another. One suspects that for the cycle in the Middle East, which is, again, thankfully far less violent than those cataclysmic experiences of Europe, but for the cycle of violence and competition in the Middle East to change, perhaps something similar is needed, some kind of recognition by all the leading states that actually, you know, as Barack Obama said, quite controversially actually at the time, there's a need to learn to share the region rather than to compete for it. And now, whether or not that kind of behavior, you know, that kind of far-sighted leadership is possible, I don't know. But structurally, one suspects that until something like that takes place, some kind of permanent recognition that the region needs to be shared, that actually this constant competition in regions of instability is actually going to be a recipe for instability ongoing, then I think we're going to see instability in the region in some capacity. Now, whether or not that can happen, I don't know. But I think that sort of structural factor is really important to understand when you're trying to understand why this region is unstable. And therefore, it's not about religion or the legacies of colonialism or the presence of oil or US imperialism. All of those factors have helped create this environment that we look at. But today, it's about that distribution of power and the inability for one to dominate, and a recognition that actually they need to find some way to work out a functioning status quo that doesn't lead to interference in one another's affairs and, you know, proxy wars and instability.
That was Christopher Phillips. Many thanks to him for joining for episode 217. Remember, we do need your support to keep Turkey Book Talk going, and you can give that support by joining as a Turkey Book Talk member on Patreon. Membership gets you a 35% discount on all Turkey Ottoman history books published by IB Taurus and Bloomsbury, transcripts of every interview, transcripts of the entire archive of interviews, and links via email to articles and other content related to the subject of each episode. For all that, just go to Turkey Book Talk's Patreon account and pledge $3, €3, or £2.50 per episode. Do also rate the podcast or write a positive review wherever you listen. Spread the word, give us a shout out on your own social media accounts. Follow via our website, turkeybooktalk.com. Follow on Twitter or X, Facebook or Instagram, or all of them. Recommend Turkey Book Talk to a friend or a foe. And I always enjoy hearing from listeners, so do send any feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. And finally, let me once again remind you to check out a friend of Turkey Book Talk, Turkey Recap. Turkey Recap is a weekly email newsletter that brings together all major developments in Turkey over the past 7 days, links to interesting articles, and some excellent puns. They've got a Slack channel for signed up members who want more, and they also publish high quality original on the ground reporting. Just go to turkeyrecap.com and follow the links there to subscribe. But until our next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening.